So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone, or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
A Rayo Original Podcast.
Dame Truly,
do you have any predictions as to what your biological age will be?
Maybe you're going to tell me my biological age is 100 and so I should be dead.
Your chronological age is 86. I can reveal that your biological age is... Hello and welcome to What's My Age Again, the only podcast where we demand our guests' actual blood. Sweat and tears are encouraged, but optional. Today's guest is a Michelin star chef, award-winning author, TV host, and national treasure. Of course, I'm talking about the dazzling Dame Prulith, our third dame on the series so far. There's only one way to describe this Wonder Woman, and that is a force to be reckoned with. As well as devoting her life to producing top-notch, she's run multiple businesses, written 12 cookbooks, 9 novels, campaigned to teach cooking in schools, worked tirelessly for charities to improve the standard of school food, all while finding time to be a loving wife, mother, and grandmother. But has this bustling life played havoc on her biological age? Has spinning so many plates put her health in a downward spiral? Or is the key to youth keeping your mind and your outfit sharp? Dame Prulith is 86 years old, but today we will find out if her cells agree. Dame Prulith, welcome to What's My Age Again.
Hello, Catherine. It sounds terrifying.
Why?
Maybe you're going to tell me my biological age is 100 and so I should be dead.
I might tell you that. But I don't think so. You look, as ever, vivacious, healthy, young, full of energy. Your new book is called Being Old and Learning to Love It. How do you react when someone tells you that you look young? Do you think that's a good thing, a weird thing?
Well, no, I love it. Of course, I like the idea that I look younger than I am. But I don't mind being old.
No.
I mean, I really wrote the book because I felt that... oldies were getting a bad rap, and it's partly their old fault because there's a kind of idea that being old is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
But being old is just like being young. Some of it's terrible and some of it's wonderful. And there are lots of great things about being old.
So you say that with authority as though you are old. So when...
I am old.
When did you first identify as being old?
You know, when I got the Bake Off job, I was 70 or something.
Mm.
Or 71. And I remember thinking, God, they're mad. I'm old. I might not live long enough to do this, to do a good job, you know.
Maybe they count on that because they're a ceiling on the pay rises. So maybe old is good for
them.
Oh,
you think? That's very cunning.
What made you decide that after 9 years, that was the time to leave?
Well, it's mainly just because I'm very conscious that I'm not going to live forever. And I've got limited time left. And I realized that I would never get a European holiday, you know, go to Italy or France or Greece or Spain, all the countries I love and I've not been to enough. I'll never be able to go to them in the summer again because the Bake Off films all through the summer. So I just thought, you know, I've got to stop. So that was the main reason, but also because I want to do more television that's different.
Yeah.
I always want to do new stuff.
Yeah.
And Bake Off was absolutely wonderful. I loved it and I loved the people and all the rest of it. But it wasn't new. Every year was exactly the same, except, you know, new bakers and new cakes.
Yeah. I think 9 years is a long time
to be in the same project when you're someone who spins many plates and has different interests. It's like you didn't get into an office job for a reason. There are people who sit in an office for 50 years.
I know.
And someone who's creative.
Mind you, I'm quite a sticker. I mean, nine years is quite a long time. But before that, I did the Great British Menu, the Great British Menu program. And I did that for 11 years. So I am quite a stayer. And I did love Bake Off. And I could have gone on happily doing Bake Off because I was enjoying it. But, you know, in the end, it was shrinking horizons that was forced me into it.
They've gone for someone with less sex appeal, Nigella Lawson. Happens to me all the time. I like that you count your life in summers because we both have children. But when your children are small, they say to you, you've only got 18 summers with your children. If they say 18 years, that's fine. But if they go 18 summers, count the summers.
Then there's something in that.
So what does your ideal summer look like? Would you stay on the back of your husband's motorcycle, go in on a pub crawl of the Cotswolds?
I'd certainly do that. I don't want to stop doing that. That's lovely. It's very comfy. It's a big Harley Davidson trike. So it's got two back wheels. So it's really comfy and it can't tip over. So you're not frightened on it.
Yeah.
I don't like being on the back of a motorbike very much because it feels dangerous. But this feels safe as anything.
Have you been on the back of many motorbikes, Pearl?
I've been back on a few.
How many?
I've been back on Paul Hollywood scooter.
Wow. Going from Paul Hollywood scooter to John's Harley, I think I'd feel a lot safer in his hands. What is the one thing that you believe will have the biggest impact on your biological age today?
I think I should have quite a young biological age because I sleep like a top. And if I had an hour off here before my next meeting and you said I could lie here, I could just fall asleep for an hour.
Really?
I can sleep anywhere and I go to sleep very quickly. And I sleep 8 hours every night almost without fail, always.
Perfect.
And I eat very healthily. I don't eat neurotically healthily. I'm not on some keto diet or anything.
No.
I just cook everything from fresh. We never buy ultra-processed anything. And it's not a religion. It's just that I like cooking. Yeah. And I like cooking from scratch. And I like healthy food. And we buy all our veg from a local farmer's market. So it's really fresh.
Mm-hmm.
And so on those two scores, the eating and the sleeping, I should do all right. What was the third thing?
Well, it's about just your general well-being, if you're happy in your relationship.
Yeah, all that too.
If you have past trauma or stress that's written on the canvas of who you are.
Well, I should do well on that too because I'm really happy and I've had a very happy life. And I've had a tremendously lucky life. Of course, there have been some problems, you don't get to be 86 without a bit of, when my first husband died, that was widowhood. The first year, 2 years of widowhood really sucks. I mean, that's horrible. But that was years ago, and it happens to everybody.
Tell me about that. So you were married to your husband, Rain, for how many years?
Yeah, my first years. Yes, I was married to him for a very long time.
Yeah.
And but he was older than me, so I always knew he'd die before me. He was 20 years older than me. He died when he was 82.
Okay.
So I was 64 or something.
That's very young to be a widow.
But then 8 years later, I met John. So that was terrifically lucky.
Yeah.
And, most people don't get one happy marriage.
No.
And I've had two really happy marriages. And I'm still having the second one, so as long as he sticks around.
So what was that first year of widowhood like? Was your husband sick for a long time?
He had been sick for a long time.
Okay.
And so the 2 years before he died were stressful because I knew he was, he was very insisted that I kept working and that I did what I needed to do. So I would sometimes go off and get on a train and then just worry about him so much I'd get off at the next station and come back again because I would be worried about him. And occasionally I'd come home and he would have collapsed and because he couldn't breathe properly. He had emphysema. He was a walking lesson on not smoking because he smoked himself to death. And there was quite a lot of stress in that last couple of years. I can't tell you how many times I followed an ambulance to a hospital because he'd have collapsed because he couldn't breathe. So that wasn't good.
Yeah.
But it was a, it was only a few years, I suppose, a couple of years before he died, and then the pain of him actually being gone. But I had my family around me, and they were wonderful. And your children really step up when something terrible happens. Mm-hmm. You know, they both came home, stayed with me for weeks after he died.
Because I would have thought the opposite. Someone like you, as strong as you are and as insightful, you know, the matriarch, you would have to hold everyone together because it's their father who's passed as well. But you raised them to hold you up.
Yes, I think they held me together, really.
That's great. And then
Maybe we all held each other, really.
Yeah. And it was around that time that you realized how few friends you had?
In this book, I talk about friendship because I've never been good at friendship. I've always worked very hard and been very close to all the people I worked with, but I've never worked that friendship. And when I lived with my first husband, we lived in the country, and he was really reclusive. He was a writer, and he never wanted to see anybody. And he didn't want to know our neighbours. He sort of lived in fear that, you know, people would come banging on the door wanting to borrow a cup of sugar or something. He had completely... wrong idea how the British behave anyway.
Yeah.
They don't do that. And I was quite happy to live this reclusive life in the country because we had the children. And then I would go to work in the week and come home at weekends. And the children came home at weekends because they were at boarding school. And so we were a very happy little family at the weekends. But I didn't want anybody else because I lived this very busy life in London. I was running my businesses and I was going to my restaurant every night. And so I was seeing lots of friends in the restaurant and I was very social. So, you know, I thought it was fine. And then, of course, when he died, I suddenly realized that I had no friends in the country. I knew none of our neighbors. We'd never been friends with our neighbors. And that was really hard, made it more difficult. But I didn't want to leave the house. But Rain had expected me to, when he died, he thought I'd go and live in our London flat, but I loved the country. So anyway, I did find that really difficult. And then 8 years later, I met John, and he knows everybody in our world, in the Cotswolds. He knows everybody from the, you know, ask him who the best electrician is, and he'll know not only the electrician and the plumber and everybody. He knows who they're married to, how many children they've got. He knows everybody. And then he knows all the toffs and poshos and lords and ladies and who they're married to and who their children are. So he is enormously gregarious. He has hundreds of friends. So now I have lots of friends, which is really lucky because I wouldn't have any friends.
It's no wonder Rain didn't want you getting to know the neighbors because John is one of your neighbors.
That's right. Yeah, that's true.
And as soon as you got to know him, you were well connected in the Cotswolds.
Well, no, I don't think that would have ever happened because I think, you know, if you're really committed to one person, you don't look at other people.
I totally understand that.
You know, you don't lust after that good-looking guy across the table if you're in love with the one that's sitting next to you.
He's not that good in bed anyway. I've heard this from a lot of women that, especially of a certain generation, to be a dutiful wife and a dutiful mother, you fit yourself around your husband and you've broken out of that because you had all these businesses and you're in London, you were so successful. I think you're quite different. But in terms of a social circle, your friends are your husband's friends' wives.
Yeah.
And then
my husband didn't have any.
And he didn't have any, so you didn't have any.
Well, he had a couple of old friends, but they were Londoners, and they would come occasionally and stay with us or something. But he had a few, you know, he had perhaps three friends.
Okay.
But we were very close to the family, and we had quite a big family between us.
So you're running out of closet space. The good news? You don't need to stop shopping. You just need to start selling with The RealReal. The RealReal is the world's largest and most trusted resource for authenticated luxury resale. Whether it's that mini bag that can't even fit your phone or those boots you never fully broke in, The RealReal handles everything from photography and copywriting to shipping and pricing. So you can just sit back, get paid, and make room for things that actually feel like you. And with 10,000 plus new arrivals every single day from top designers like Prada, Celine, Louis Vuitton, and Loewe, all for up to 90% off retail, you're bound to find something perfectly on brand to fill that extra closet space with. Plus, right now, you can get an extra $100 to shop when you sell for the first time. Make room for what feels like you. Go to TheRealReal.com to start selling and get your extra $100 to keep shopping at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com. Terms apply.
What's the biggest lesson that age has taught you thus far?
Do you know, I think the thing I like best about being old is that you simply don't care anymore what people think. You do what you want to do. And my advice, if it was advice, and this is not a how-to book. It's not full of advice. It's more full of, I hope, amusing and fun to read stories. But if I haven't any advice, it would be just enjoy it. There are great things about being old, and one of the best of them is that you can do what you like.
Were there times in your life that you weren't that way, that you would do what other people wanted you to do, that you didn't just go for it? Because you strike me as someone who's always been very much that way anyhow.
When you're working in a company or anything else, you are really concerned about everybody else as well. I mean, you realize this is a ship that requires a lot of people to drive it. You know, it's you can't just... I think the nice thing about getting old is that you give up all those sort of things. And in the end, it's just your own life you're managing. You're no longer managing your children's lives. You're no longer managing your businesses. You're not worrying about your employees. You're not worrying about anything, really. You can do what you like.
When you're managing these businesses and the boss in so many arenas of your life, because you're a woman, did anybody call you a bitch during that time?
I mean, I was often the first woman doing lots of things. I mean, in a way, I was really lucky because, for example, I was the first woman on, I ended up on about 10 or 11 major boards, like, you know, the board of Safeway and the board of Whitbread and the board of British Rail and all sorts of companies. Because at the time, chairman had just woken up to the fact that they really would be a good idea to have women at the top. Mm-hmm. And they wanted to encourage more women to be promoted. And they figured that if they could have some women at the top, then, you know, on the board. I don't think they necessarily wanted you to do anything. You just had to be a statutory woman, just be there. And of course, I because I had a successful business, I was one of the targets that people wanted me to be on their boards because I had credibility as a businesswoman. Mm-hmm. And so I was often on boards that I didn't mind why they were putting me there. I always thought, well, it'd be interesting to, you know, I've never been in a building society, so I'd love to join the Leeds Permanent Building Society. Well, I know nothing about trains, so I'd like to be on, you know. I always joined things because I was curious and I wanted to do something new. But I also wanted to do a good job.
Yeah.
And so I think, I don't care why you're putting me there. Maybe you just want me to be a statutory woman, and I don't care about that. As long as when I'm there, I can do the job. Mm. And, you know, it was the right attitude because it meant I got on the board and then I did do a good job, and then they would suddenly think, oh. And what I'm really proud of is I never left a board without having more women on the board than when I arrived. There was nobody when I arrived. But mostly when I left, there'd be a couple of women on that board because I began to almost seek out bright women who would be helpful.
Were you always very fashionable on these boards? Or did that fashion sense come later?
No, I do remember getting an invitation to also on British Rail, to an invitation to a board dinner. And it said, and the invitation just said, it was printed, it said, please ask your wife to wear a long dress. So I said to my husband, come on, you're going to wear a dress and I'm going to wear a dinner suit to go to this thing. But he wouldn't do it. But I would have loved to have turned up. I did turn up in a dinner jacket because it said dinner jackets.
Yeah.
You know, dinner jackets for you and long dress for your wife. But my husband wouldn't wear a dress. But I did wear a dinner jacket.
Well, you walked the runway for Vin and Omi at London Fashion Week on the eve of your 86th birthday.
That was so amazing.
Yeah.
Do you know, I walked down that runway. I love Vin and Omi. I think they're great designers. And, you know, they have a great mission to make design sustainable. Mm-hmm. And my dress was made out of linen-like subject fabric, but it was actually made of holly. From one of the royal estates. They have some collaboration with the king that they can make fabrics out of all their waste material. Wow. So it's hedge trimmings, holly hedge trimmings. But I never know what dress I'm getting or what I'm going to wear when I walk down. But I had this amazing pink suit with a big frilly shirt, and it was fun. And I was walking down this catwalk, but it's a catwalk in a hotel and you're going all over the place. Mm-hmm. And there are about 800 people lining the catwalk, mostly press and photographers, but also fashionistas and you know, people who are interested in fashion. And there were 800 of them. And as we turned every corner, there'd be a new burst of happy birthday. Everybody was singing happy birthday to me. And I was quite tearful by the end because it was so... It's just extraordinary to hear, you know, 800 people singing happy birthday. It was so lovely. They turned the whole thing into my birthday party, which was incredibly generous because what they're supposed to be doing is pushing their sustainability mm-hmm. message, not my age message.
But I like that you embrace your birthday and you felt tearful in a positive way to hear happy birthday because there are women, especially older than me, who were taught to fear age, to reject age, to lie and conceal age. Yes. And certainly my mother is only 66, just turned 66 a couple days ago. Yeah. She does not like the idea of getting older. And she has to hear messages like yours. She has to train herself. So she'll say things like, well, it's better than the alternative, which is very black, like very dark. Yeah. But it's true. It's wonderful. It's a privilege to get older. Yeah. And do you feel more beautiful now as you get older?
Do you know, I feel much more comfortable in my skin. I mean, when I was young, I really worried about how I looked a lot, much more. I was thinking, oh my God, I got bags under my eyes. And one of the lessons, which is so extraordinary, I would like to say to young women is, for goodness sake, enjoy your beauty and your youth and your, you know, young people are just so lovely anyway. They don't need to do anything. It really upset to see all these young girls with, you know, inflated boobs and Botox lips and all the rest of it when they don't need it.
You don't have to say young girls. You can just say me. I'm right here, Prue. I know that I've really messed it up in some ways. I got breast implants when I was really young as well. Really young.
Did you? Yeah. You see, I think that, you know, You're a beautiful woman. You don't need to do that. And I bet you were just as beautiful before. You know?
Much more beautiful.
Much more beautiful.
And I think breast implants might have given me autoimmune disease. I do think...
Really?
I loved them at the time because I got to go to the Playboy Mansion before we knew Hugh Hefner was so dangerous and complicated. And I had a facelift 2 months ago.
Oh, darling, you don't need to do these things. You see, I really worry about that because I think when I look at pictures of me when I was young, mm-hmm. I think, what was I worrying about? Mm. I mean, that's a good-looking girl. You know, she didn't need, but I was, I mean, I didn't do any of those things because I couldn't afford them and they weren't available. But I'm sure I would have because I was convinced that I was... too tall, too clumsy, too big, too fat, too everything. Yeah. And you know, it's mad. And now I'm very comfortable. I think, you know, I'm fine.
So you wouldn't do any like surgical procedures?
No, I had, in my life I have. I mean, when I was 50, I had the bags under my eyes fixed. And then they said it'll last for 15 years, and it did. And then I got the bags back, but now I don't care. That's one of the things about, I mean, I think I look fine with the bags.
Well, you haven't really got them, though. I think the surgery was a success. You don't have them half as noticeable as people half your age. I think you look great. But so that's not Botox. That's not.
No.
Do you get any laser facials?
I didn't do any of those things.
No,
I've never done anything like that. And I think there's quite a lot about this in the book because mm-hmm. I think there's a huge con that manufacturers are making lots of money selling pots of cream that cost £300 or something, which are guaranteed to get rid of your wrinkles or something. And, you know, it's just nonsense. I mean, I remember Anita Roddick saying many years ago that the property in one of those expensive pots of cream are no different. The sort of moisturizing properties are exactly the same as on any fat. So it could be mutton fat, and primitive people would use mutton fat on their faces to moisturize them. She said, just as effective.
Yeah.
All you're paying for is the packaging and the marketing and a little bit, and the profit. And a tiny little bit of money goes into the actual product.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just hate the fact that so many young girls are... I think social media is bad for this too because it persuades them that they have to do all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it is... We have been taught, I think, in my age group, that your body is a trend. Mm-hmm. So sometimes breast implants are fashionable, sometimes a big bum.
Well,
what do you think of the big bum trend?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you notice that one?
Yeah.
I liked it, but luckily I was too busy to go for it. Otherwise, I'd be sitting
had a big bum too.
A bit higher up in this interview. And then fillers and Botox. I do agree with you. As much as I enjoy luxury beauty products. Mm. Some of them are silky or some of them smell really nice.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yes.
But I've read the same studies that any moisturizer, you should moisturize, you should use SPF.
Yes,
yeah. And then sometimes an acid at night, like a retinol or a vitamin A. But really,
sure
they say
that's
all you need.
People often ask me, what do you put on your face? You know, what's your go-to? If they think I'm going to say some, you know, really fashionable, smart brand, and I always say, well, I just steal those little bottles in the hotels. You know, you get little bottles. And I don't care whether it's called face cream or body lotion or balm or whatever. It's all the same stuff, and it just all goes on my face, whatever it's called.
So what's your beauty secret? Robbery.
It is. Robbery. Stealing out of hotels. That's what I do. And if I can't do that, I'll just go for Nivea because Nivea is not expensive. And they've got the good sense to tell you that, for example, if you buy a Nivea bottle of shampoo, it says body wash, good for hair, face, everything.
Yeah.
So one bottle can do the lot. You don't need all that stuff.
So you never found being in the public eye that aging was a detriment or aging would prevent you from getting higher?
Well, for me, it's been a huge advantage. I wouldn't be here if I wasn't 86. If I was 66, I wouldn't be here. You've invited me because I'm old. So there are advantages.
What are your opinions about, like, there are certain men, especially famous men, who have only ever dated much younger women.
Yeah.
What do you think about that? Do you think they're intimidated by women their own age? Do you think maybe they're not clever enough to chat to women their own age?
I don't know what it is. I mean, I've got a friend who is exactly like that. He's unhappy because he's on his own, but all he wants is very young women. And I think, really. I mean, he wants a lasting relationship. It's not as if he just wants a one-night stand. I understand that. You probably want the most beautiful girl you can find if all you're looking for is, you know.
But he wants a lasting relationship.
If you want a lasting relationship, you should not be going for, you know, if you're in your 50s, as he is, you should not be going for girls in their 20s.
And do you tell him that?
Yeah, I do, all the time.
And what's his reaction?
He's not turned on by older women. He just...
But he's friends with you.
I know, but then he's not lusting after me. He's just a friend.
But I think you've got to cut him off because the intellectual stimulation that he's getting from you, he does not deserve.
Well, that's an interesting thing. And maybe if he didn't have older women friends he can talk to, he would give up the young ones because he can't talk to them.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think that's true. There are, of course, there are young, interesting women and young, bright women. They're not all tits and teeth, you know?
There are, of course, interesting, bright young women, but there's something about these older men exclusively choosing them that makes me feel like they want to exploit their vulnerability somehow or they want to, you know, lead
them. They feel more masterful, maybe.
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't want to make myself look young for the male gaze. I know that. I'm not for the male gaze. I'm for the male gaze. But I still like it. Like, there was something about my neck that after having all my pregnancies was bothering me. I did it for myself.
Yeah.
Or do you think I've been tricked by a
I'm not against plastic surgery.
Yeah.
Blanketed. I mean, in there, I tell the story of my mum, who, she was an actress, and she had very big boobs. And when she was 70, she decided she'd have her bosoms smallened.
Yeah.
Made. And I was so cross with her. I remember getting really cross with her. Mum, this is just a cry for attention. All you want is me to spend 3 weeks with you looking after you, because it's a major operation. And you won't be able to lift your arms and all this. But, and it's just an excuse for me to be there. Because I said, after all, what does it matter? Nobody's ever, you're not going to show your, I mean, nobody's going to look at your tits anymore. So, so she said, this is not about... anybody else. She said, I'm doing it for me. She said, I've always hated my bosoms. They've always been too big. And she said, when I was a young actress in the 30s, I had to strap them in because the fashion at the time was to look like a boy, you know, the sort of salad days look.
Yes.
So she said, when I was a young actress, I was always having to strap them up. And she said, the only reason that I didn't do anything earlier, she said, your father... was rather fond of them, that's why I kept. But she said he's no longer around, so I'm now doing what I want, and I'm having him off. I'm having them. So she went ahead and had it, and do you know, because she immediately felt lighter, she started to diet more because she had got very overweight. She lost a lot of weight. She started working again. It cheered her up so much. And then she got an enormous acting job playing the lead in a big play. And I swear she wouldn't have got to that without the surgery. It just changed her image of herself. Yeah. And then she thought, well, it was worth... She went back to wearing high heels, which she had stopped wearing. It just changed her life. So it's a good thing.
Yeah,
I mean, can be a good thing.
But it's great to feel settled in yourself and that you don't need it. That is the ideal, of course. I see what you're saying. I love, love your advocacy of getting children, especially, more comfortable around fresh fruits and vegetables and people cooking more. Yeah. I think that if your biological age is low, our resident scientist, Nicola, always goes on about how important that is. And especially because you're getting fruit and veg from this local... Yeah. farmer's market that will have actual nutrients and vitamins in it. What are the high processed foods that you think people should majorly avoid? Like, what would you never eat? If you hadn't eaten all day and I presented you with some type of salami.
This is really difficult because since I never ever eat that stuff, I mean, I just don't even walk past those shelves I don't know what they are, but I mean,
the horse meat scandal meant nothing to you.
I tell you what I feel guilty about.
Yeah.
I mean, I do. There are some things that I just buy off the shelf because I'm lazy.
Okay.
Mayonnaise is one of them. And if you look at a jar of mayonnaise, it does have some ultra processed rubbish in it. It's not just what it should be, which is just egg yolks and oil, and a little bit of lemon juice and salt and pepper. But I will always eat things like, you know, I'll use frozen mashed potato, and I feel very comfortable about that because if you look at what's in the frozen mashed potato, it is just potato and salt and butter. And that's what you do at home.
Yeah.
So that's all right. So I do have, and same with, I will use frozen puff pastry because it's just flour and butter.
What? I can see the tabloid headlines now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it takes a long time to make puff pastry. Yeah. And so I often cheat. So I'm not against cheating if the ingredients are good. But I think the things I feel a bit guilty about is, and I don't want to look at the ingredient list because I'm sure they won't be, there'll be all sorts of stabilizers and other rubbish in them. But I buy packet custard, you know, the one that's in a, and I like the one called the sort of Tesco's Madagascar, Madagascar vanilla custard.
Okay. It's
absolutely delicious. And I make trifle out of that.
Ooh.
And we get through quite a lot because my husband loves custard.
Custard's great.
And I'm sure that's probably full of ultra-processed rubbish.
It's very interesting to know that you buy pre-made custard, yet you forced me to try to create my own on Stand Up to Cancer Bake Off, and I failed miserably, and it was hard as a rock. And then you didn't eat my pie because you said it wasn't worth the calories. Do you count calories?
I do. I think anybody of my age knows what calories they're eating all the time.
Yeah.
And I do. And I aim at eating not more than 2,000 a day, which is about right for my weight and size and sex and everything. And I can usually count up in my head what I've eaten.
Wow. You just know instinctively
Yeah. Because I think my generation grew up very fixated about calories. That was the only thing we were concerned about was just not to put on weight.
Yeah.
By the calories. Whereas diets today are a bit more complicated. They're not just about calories, but I still reckon in calories.
And so on certain bake-off shoot days, would you have just cake as long as it was under 2,000?
I just eat cake. And you know, usually if I ate a teaspoon of every cake and there were perhaps, you know, it would be that, say on the day that they're doing the technical and the signature challenge, that would mean I'd have to do perhaps two mouthfuls of times 12 because of 12 bakers if it's right at the beginning. And I'd end up with perhaps 40 teaspoons of cake.
Yeah.
And that would be about 1,500 calories. And then I'd have in my head, I'd have 500 calories left for dinner.
Yeah.
And I'd decide, well, actually two glasses of wine would be better than dinner. So my diet for 2 days a week for 10 weeks of the year would be, honestly, cake and wine.
Great.
You know, 1,500, obviously, as there are less and less bakers, it's much easier to stay under the calorie count because you're not eating so much.
That's fine.
But so I'm sure cake and wine is not a recommended diet. But
no.
I would do it for 10 weeks a year.
But whatever.
Or 2 days in every week. For 10 days.
But whatever that's done to your biological age, it will have hopefully bounced back since you left.
Well, we'll see. Perhaps all that cake and wine has not been good for me. We don't know.
We'll see. The British public will be absolutely disappointed if that is not a good way to live your life. What are your thoughts about death? Does that scare you?
It doesn't scare me at all. It absolutely doesn't scare me. What scares me, or would scare me, is I think if you're ill and you're in pain and you're unhappy, you ought to be allowed to die if you want to. Mm. So I spend a lot of time advocating assisted dying, and at the moment the bill is going through Parliament, but it looks likely to fail because in the House of Lords, there are a little bunch of lords who have decided to filibuster, to absolutely, if a bill runs out of time because it hasn't been properly debated, mm-hmm. because there hasn't been time, if it runs out of time, it automatically falls, and then you have to start again the next parliament and go right through the House of Commons and everything. It's already been through the House of Commons who approved it and want to see it made law. And it's supposed to go to the Lords. The Lords are supposed to scrutinise and improve bills. They're there to check bills, make sure that they are the best that they can be. They're not there. They're not meant to deliberately sink them or bury them. And there's this bunch of Lords who have tabled over 1,000 amendments which have to be discussed, simply in order to make sure that the bill runs out of time and it fails. And that's so undemocratic.
Yeah.
And it's absolutely not what the Lords is for. And a lot of the Lords, even those who are opposed to assisted dying, don't want the bill to succeed, totally disagree what this little cabal of law lords are doing, which is, you know, all these ridiculous amendments, because they say that's not what we're meant to do. It's not the right use of the Lords. It's bringing the Lords into disrepute. It's undemocratic. It means we can't vote because it'll run out of time. So it's disgraceful.
In a way, it's metaphorical for the need for assisted death. They're just letting it prolong and prolong and prolong when it could be voted for or against. Mm. I'm really sorry to hear that. So that's something that's really meaningful
to
you.
That's happening at the moment. So if it does fall, they'll, I mean, something like 80% of the public want to see this bill through.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and the organizations, mostly charities that are pushing for it, they won't give up. They'll just try again. But this, you know, it's monstrous.
It sort of exists, maybe I'm wrong, I think it exists in a space with termination of pregnancies where they go, they just put their hands up and they get so frozen by the idea of life and death and life and death and what to do with
it. And interfering. I think a lot of the opposition is genuinely moral. You know, people feel, all religious, that they feel, you know, God giveth, so God taketh away. It's not our business to interfere. But I feel very strongly, nonsense, it's my life. I should be able to, I believe in autonomy of your body. I think you own your body and you should be allowed to do what you like with it. Up to a point. I mean, I don't think you should be allowed to, if you're insane, you shouldn't be allowed to cut your arm off. But when it's just your own life and you're really unhappy and you are in constant pain and you know you're going to get, the pain is going to get worse, and no drugs can touch it, then we wouldn't do that to a dog.
No.
We wouldn't, you know.
I absolutely agree.
You know, and if you were on a battlefield and your colleague was obviously dying, you know, shot to ribbons and unsavable, but in agony, you would put a bullet through him, wouldn't you, out of compassion?
Yeah.
You'd, you know. But apparently we can't do that to people who are desperately ill and in pain.
Well, we'll see. Maybe you'll be one of the people to change that.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. I hope to live long enough to do it. You see, that's one of the... People often say, do you think about death? Well, I do think, will I live long enough to see this bill through?
Well, you shouldn't be skiing if that's your aim. I saw you tried to ski for the first time when you were 80 years old.
Well, I did something called sit skiing, which is absolutely cheating. You sit in a basically in a chair on skis with a really champion skier behind you, and he skis. It's so exciting, and you get all the excitement of, because you go just as, I mean, my children were skiing, and they're good skiers, round us because they wanted to take photographs of us as we were skiing, and we were tearing down the slopes just as fast as everybody else. Absolutely magical. And the wonderful thing is, because you're not in control, you are absolutely in somebody else's hands. There's something completely liberating about it. the stress just disappears. You get all the excitement and the pleasure, but none of the anxiety because you're not doing it. Somebody else is. And in fact, there's something amazing about the feeling that if that guy just opens his hands and lets you go, you're a goner. I mean, there's something great about somebody else being in charge.
I think you probably feel that way because you're in charge so often.
Yeah.
So this is like a tailored Dame Prulith way to kick back. Are you doing any other exercise?
No, I do. I do ridiculous exercise because a physio who I much admire told me that I have to do at least half an hour. She said 45 minutes actually of exercise every day. And she taught me these exercises, so they're really simple. I wake up in the morning and I do them do three of them before I get out of bed, which is the one where you you roll your legs this way and that way, and then I do one sort of leg lifts, 30 of them, and then 30 bicycling legs. So they're the leg ones I do before I even get out of bed.
But Sir John likes that routine.
And then I do a whole lot of exercises for my thighs and my ankles and so on and so on. And it's supposed to take 45 minutes. Well, it takes me 10 minutes because I find them so boring that I just rush at it and I just do it. I do it at top speed. At the end, I'm quite out of breath, but I have done them all. And I reckon it's probably useless 10 minutes exercise, but it's better than nothing. And I do cook a lot and I pot around the garden and and I'm quite active for my age.
Do you have any predictions as to what your biological age will be?
No, but based on what you've said about that it should be that it's about how much you sleep, how well you sleep and how well you eat, and how stress-free your life is and how happy you are. Well, if it's all those things, I should be 25 because honestly, I know I eat well, I know I sleep well, and I'm really happy.
Great.
And so I've got no, I shouldn't have anything to make me old.
Well, would you like to invite Dr. Nicola Conlon on set with me and we'll reveal your biological age? Dame Prulith. We are now joined by our resident scientist, Dr. Nicola Conlon, who has dedicated her entire career to these longevity studies, human longevity. Your chronological age is 86. I can reveal that your biological age is 48, 38 years younger, which is the biggest gap that we have ever had on the show. So
really?
Yeah.
This is. I am 38. So you are a whole me younger.
How
biologically?
Amazing.
It's honestly. So we've had some guests that have had some really good results, and I've used words like wow, this is amazing, but yours is by far the best. Like it is exceptional in terms of what we measure.
So I must be doing something right then.
You are definitely. So what you just finished with before was talking about your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. So your diet, your exercise, your sleep, being happy. These are all the things that everyone gets so bored of me saying on this show, but this actually shows it really does work. When you do all those things right, it really does make a difference. And what we actually look at in the test is something called glycans. So these are things that are on your immune cells. So they show levels of inflammation and we look at the different patterns. And there's different ones that we look at. And basically, you get kind of scored from like low to high. And in every single one, you were in the top 1%.
Wow.
So yeah, so like very... very good. When I say good, I'm not exaggerating. It's very, very good.
Well, I'm really impressed.
Yeah. And I think for me, what's exciting about this is, so you just mentioned, like I specialize in longevity. Mm. And a lot of people, when we talk about longevity, they think, why would I want to live longer? Like, or why would I want to be old? Whatever that's defined as. Because unfortunately, for a lot of people, advanced ages mean chronic disease. Mm-hmm. They mean not having a great, end of life. Mm-hmm. And this is where we focus on something that's called health span rather than lifespan. Mm. So your health span is actually the proportion of life that you live in good health, you know, fulfilled, happy, like exactly what you're describing, you know, having purpose. And unfortunately for most people, we have this major gap, which is a big problem in society. So for us as women, our health span is expected to be only 63 years, but our lifespan, our average lifespan is 83. And to be in a position where you are at your age and be able to live a happy, fulfilled life with no chronic disease is very, very rare. So 99% of people over the age of 80 will have a chronic disease that limits them from being able to be fulfilled and happy. So you are like the poster girl of health span. So for me, that's exciting because it shows that by making changes, you know, not having to do any of the crazy extreme things that sometimes we talk about, you know, but just avoiding the ultra processed food, cooking, home cooking, you know, being happy.
And I do think sleeping is so important.
Oh, sleep is a big one. Yeah. Yeah.
Sleeping well, because I think a lot of people, you know, it's easy to say you need good sleep, but if you're stressed and you can't sleep, that's really hard. So I mean, these things are all connected, aren't they? You know, happiness makes you more relaxed, and therefore you can sleep better. If you're unhappy, it affects your sleep, it affects everything.
Yeah, it's a vicious circle.
And it probably makes you eat a lot of sugar and rubbish because you're comfort eating.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing kicks into another, doesn't it?
If you have chronic pain.
And that's where luck plays such a good... I mean, I'm really lucky to be... to have had such a happy life. And, you know, I've had quite a few moments when I've had, you know, accidents or been in hospital or... And once I got an infection in my back and I was in the hospital for ages and nobody knew what was the matter with me and it was... terrible, but once it got fixed, I mean, I do think modern medicine is amazing because, you know, I mean, I'm a great believer in you shouldn't suffer pain. You know, if you've got a headache, for God's sake, take a paracetamol. Mm-hmm. Don't, there's no virtue in being brave. But some people are very scared of medication or,
yeah.
And or surgery or, you know, they're sort of suspicious of the medical world. Well, I'm all for grabbing what it can give me.
Yeah, everything's right in the right circumstance, absolutely. And I think as well, like I was laughing when you said you spent 10 weeks eating cake and drinking wine. And again, it shows that those things aren't necessarily terrible for us.
Yeah.
It's balance, it's moderation.
I noticed there's cake here.
I feel like we should have had a special cake.
Yeah, that looks quite special to me.
But it is, you know, people can enjoy their lives and it's not about restriction, it's not about never doing anything wrong or, you know, keeping everything
in line. The other thing you haven't mentioned and I think is incredibly important is some kind of, it doesn't have to be love of a, it's love, but it doesn't have to be love of a man or a woman or a partner. It could be love of your dog or love of history or love of... I think you need an interest and a... I don't really like the word passion, but you know what I mean. You need something that is somewhere near an obsession, something that you really, really care about. And you need a purpose. You need
some purpose.
Purpose in life. You need you need something that to get up for, something that you need to do. And it sounds very pie and sort of, but I think you need to do stuff for other people because that brings a huge amount of satisfaction. I mean, I love cooking, but I love feeding people even more than I love cooking. And I only love cooking because I like feeding people. I think that doing stuff for other people is...
Yeah,
it's really important.
And you know, there's studies on that. So we know in certain areas of the world called blue zones, which are areas where people seem to live to much older ages, but in really good health, common themes are a sense of purpose.
Yeah.
So people, as they get older, still feel like they belong and they have a sense of purpose in the community.
Yes.
And whether that's looking
after
people.
They have a job. They do something. They, you know, they're looking after the children or they're raking the the field, or they have a job to do.
Absolutely. And unfortunately, in our society, a lot of the time people get to retirement age and then really do lose that sense of purpose because a lot of their identity or purpose was their job or going to work. And then if they don't have something else to replace that with, some interest, then it can be, it can actually be really bad for health.
Well, you are not short of purpose.
No.
Will these results impact your life in any way?
This sounds a bit too smug and self-satisfied, but the truth is, I have no complaints. Why would I have any complaints? I mean, I've got a really great family. None of us quarrel. We're all fond of each other. They're all healthy, and you know, I've had such a successful life in my various things. So, from a career point of view, from a health point of view, I've just had it all, and I still have it all. So. Of course I'm happy.
Dame Prulith, from 86 to 48 years old, the biggest gap we have ever had on What's My Age Again. Will you still be selling the book? Because you're not old.
Oh, of course I will. Being old is good fun.
Change it to being 48 and learning to love it. That was Dame Prulith. If you loved her, and I know you did, and you want to learn more about her joie de vie, about her fun, funny life, maybe even more about John, then you'll be picking up Being Old and Learning to Love It. That is her new book of many, many books. Life for Dame Prulith has been a cakewalk. Not all of our guests are so lucky. Some of them are old as shit. If you liked this episode, you can listen to more What's My Age Again wherever you get your podcasts. Please subscribe and review us and share our clips on socials and tell all your friends. If you have any friends, maybe your husband's just died and you've learned that you have no friends, but you're going to meet a new man in 8 years who has loads of friends. So it'll all be fine.
This was a Rayo Original Podcast. Rayo.